It's the Wiggin Sessions, a show where key thinkers and industry pioneers discuss politics, economics, philosophy, and history. Big ideas impacting the economy, the financial markets, and our lives. Here's your host, Addison Wiggin.
Welcome to the Wiggin Sessions. I'm your host, Addison Wiggin. Today, I'm joined by three guests, all good friends of mine, Joel Bowman, Dan Denning, and Anya Leonard. Joel is a libertarian writer, thinker, and cryptocurrency enthusiast. Dan is the co-author of the Bonner-Denning Letter, and Anya is the co-founder and director of Classical Wisdom. In this episode, we discuss the assault on the classics. What happened to classical liberal values? We discuss the American frontier spirit versus the Hegelian dialectic, cancel culture, bad money and speculative bubbles, and we ask the question, are cryptocurrencies an antidote or just more frothiness? All right, welcome to the Wiggin Sessions. This is Surviving and Thriving During the Global Pandemic, Part 39. Today we have special guests Dan Denning, Anya Leonard, and Joel Bowman. One thing that we all have in common is St. John's in different ways. Dan and I met at St. John's College in graduate school. Anya, I believe you attended St. John's for a period of time. And Joel, I'll leave the details of your experience at St. John's to the imagination.
A vicarious education, maybe.
Yeah. And some lodging.
That's debatable. Yeah, we'll see. Remains to be seen.
But the one thing that I want to talk about today to kick things off is the classics. We all were interested in the classics. Anya is a co-founder of Classical Wisdom and host of a podcast on classics in modern culture. And St. John's, if you're unaware, St. John's College is a college really that focuses on the great conversation, the classics of Western civilization, starting from pre-Greek times all the way to, the canon at St. John's ends in the early 1900s. So we all have that in common where we've been studying and interested in classics and how it pertains to trends that are going on in the economy and in our culture today. One of the things I find interesting about the classics is in our modern culture, it allows us to kind of step back and see people operate in time and space that we're not in close proximity to. So we can look at human behavior and ideas from a distance. And collectively, we've all lived in foreign countries. We've lived in France. You guys, Anya and Joel, you guys are in Buenos Aires right now. Dan, you've lived all over the world. I find like when we lived in my family, we lived in Paris for a number of years, and watching like the social environment, politics, culture, when you're not actually engaged in it, gives you a very different perspective on what's happening. You're not as closely invested in it as like politics in the United States right now. I'm talking from Baltimore, and it's difficult to extricate myself from the political discussion and how it impacts my kids and all that kind of stuff. But when we live in a foreign culture, it's easy to extricate yourself and look at the whole thing as like a grand sort of comedy. And to me, that's what the classics allow us to do too. When we're reading the Greeks or the Romans or whatever, or even like medieval Europe, we get a view on the ideas that created the culture that we live in, but we can remove ourselves from it, and it becomes interesting. Today, just to kick this off, what I'm interested in is the attack on the classics. And it's a feature of the cancel culture that we're all going through right now. Anya, you recently hosted a podcast or an event that looks at the attack on the classics, which is something that I wouldn't have suspected would be a feature of the current cultural climate that we're going through right now. Can you, just to get the conversation started, can you talk a little bit about what gave you the idea to host that event and then who attended and kind of what happened?
Yes. Well, thank you, Addison, for having me here today. And it is a really bizarre thing in a way, I got to say, because the classics, you might think it seems so innocuous. It's so ancient. I mean, how can people be so offended? But it turns out people can be offended by anything these days. So that seems to be the case. But basically what happened is in January, there was a New York Times article that came out by a prominent classicist who sort of took a saying that we shouldn't necessarily preserve this as a field and to attack the whiteness of the classics. And it's been something that just about every single person who loves the classics reads this article, and they like, it's sort of hard to get through because every paragraph you go through, you immediately come to all the defenses that you want to say. And so it is a sort of bizarre moment in history where sort of this standard, this field of history and literature and philosophy is being so questioned. But when I say that, actually, that's not the case, because the debate about the classics, it has been a long debate, and it had a huge debate in the mid-19th century as well, because in the very founding of America, you know, Greek and Latin were instrumental. You couldn't go to Harvard if you didn't pass a Greek test or a Latin test. All of the Ivy Leagues required it. And the humanities was part of the core curriculum. Around the time period when you had sort of the boom of science, and you actually had this brought over from the German universities style of more vocational universities, back then, that's when they started debating what is the value of the classics as society becomes more niche. So this is actually a debate that happened well over 100 years ago. And interestingly enough, the arguments that failed then are often the arguments people are still using today to try to come to the classics defense. So our event the other day was with the author Eric Adler, the professor of philosophy at the University of Maryland, so not too far away from you, Addison. And he basically wrote a book called The Battle of the Classics, describing the debate that happened in the 19th century. And so it's been an interesting conversation, because on the one hand, you know, there's a kind of very niche, kind of extreme Twittersphere cancelators that are, you know, wokerotis that are trying to attack the classics. But for the most part, I think a lot of people who love the classics are still able to study it. But there is bullying happen. Like I ask professors and such what happens, and sometimes they do get the attack. So it's when we had the event the other day, and it was great. We had lots and lots of turnout, really, really positive. People who select to watch these things, actually, almost all of them were kind of saying, how can we help? How can we make sure the classics stay relevant? How can we find the resources? How can we ensure the education of the classics for our children and our grandchildren? So I think the value of the humanities, and to what you said, Addison, that we're part of this long chain of humanity that is timeless, that has these lessons from the ancient world that are then, you know, are the cornerstone of further literature, further philosophy. It is our burden to make sure that this history isn't forgotten. And I think there is, I want to say optimistically, people who care about it. I like to think all of us here included.
I would like to think that too, but within the conversation, the great conversation that includes many of the ideas that led to like the founding of our country, we had an interesting discussion earlier this week about how much like the political philosophy and the ideas that went into the founding documents of the United States were rooted in the Greek and Roman tradition of experiments with both democracy, the concept of a republic, and also secular cultures, culture outside of the of religious life. But within that same conversation, within the tradition, there's also the what's known as the Hegelian dialectic, which is a view of the material world and kind of a power struggle over who controls it. And one of the things that I think is interesting is that the roots of the cancel culture that we're going through right now is rooted in this material dialectic, where rather than trying to include people in the conversation and come to a more equitable society, the idea behind cancel culture is that there's a hierarchy of power And this is something that Marx identified, Marx being a student of Hegel, and that the capitalist structure of society perpetuates stereotypes that keep certain people, in this case, white men, in power, and everyone else is sort of excluded. So the impetus behind a lot of the social justice movements right now are to cancel that idea. And that's the root of the attack on the classics these days. It's a difficult conversation to have with anybody, because especially all four of us are white people. And just even bringing up the conversation makes it difficult to have. I mean, we're in positions of having the conversation in a way that a lot of other people are not. So what I'm curious about is, what is the impact of that same tradition? Though, like you're talking about the battle of the classics, there are traditions within the classical conversation that also advocate using the same arguments that we would use to advocate a more open and liberal society, to close it and create hierarchical structures. There's a lot of different ways we could take that conversation, but I'm just wondering what you think, because you're talking to a lot of people about the same subject. It's one thing to love the classics. It's another thing to see it applied and used in society.
Yeah, I mean, there can be like a living canon. I think canons should and could and can evolve. And the canon has evolved. I mean, the original canons were so steeped in just religiosity that we wouldn't, you know, necessarily agree with them. Obviously, the original canons never included any medieval authors either. I mean, they can continuously change. And I think that's fine. We should find the virtue in history and leave out the unvirtuous, in the same way that the founding fathers, like, they didn't just take wholesale the classics. They had a conversation, essentially, with the ancients. You know, they took the things they liked, they took the things that they disliked. And I think that's the fallacy of the current cancel culture. They just, you know, say, oh, Aristotle had slaves and he couldn't count women's teeth, let's cancel him. Like, well, you know, if you really want to find anybody from the ancient world that doesn't have, or anybody from any part of the world that doesn't have something you dislike, then, you know, you're just going to erase history. And the funny thing is that you're going to erase the diverse voices that were influenced by the classics, because the classics, you know, you think of down here in Argentina, the most famous author of all of South America, of all Latin culture, Borges, was through and through a classicist. So if you want to read the best Latin author of all time, you got to read the classics. Well, are you going to cancel Borges now? You know, where does it end?
One of the more modern advocates, or like maybe I should say modern root of the cancel culture, is Antonio Gramsci. Dan, you and I have had many conversations about Gramsci and the long march through the institutions of Western society. What I really want to do is get to your analysis that you published, or that you guys put out in the Bonner Private Research recently, about how the monetary environment that we live in sort of accommodates a social movement. You connected the dots very well, in my opinion. But I want to get there through Gramsci, because Gramsci was a political philosopher in the 30s in Italy who advocated Marxist ideas of the power structure, the dialectic. But he thought that in order for it to really take hold in society, it couldn't be driven by the elites. It would have to be the institutions that educate new adherents. And so the long march through the institutions is essentially the idea that if they educate the bourgeois to understand that the proletariat needs to play a bigger role or something, that when the revolution came, then the people would be ready for it. I think part of that, so this is a long way to get to what I really want to talk about, is along with the monetary system that we live under now is one of the institutions that's accommodating effectively a revolution in the way we think about saving, entrepreneurship, educating our kids, that kind of thing. So I'm hoping that you can understand my question and then help me connect the dots there.
There are really two sides of the same coin, that the attack on the classics is an attempt to use language to redefine the culture in favor of people who have a very particular definition of power or inequality, or they have a political view. In the financial markets, it's the same thing, that people want to redefine what money means so that they can use money as a means of control. So, for example, recently there's been a huge rush of interest in central bank digital currencies. And that's not about payment systems being more efficient or more transparent. It's about the government using money as a way to control and manage people's behavior. So on the one hand, you're talking about language and thought as a way to control behavior. And on the other hand, you're talking about money and technology as a way to modify behavior. So, you know, they would seem to be different, but really we're talking about behavior modification by people in control based on political values they think are superior to tradition.
You recently, and if I get this wrong, just correct me, but you gave, I'm assuming it was a Zoom speech for the Hayek Center, and they put on a roadshow about defending more or less libertarian values as we move forward, if there's a struggle for power, and there are, and it's many, many faceted, if there's an attack on classics, if there's an attack on the definition of money and how we use it, that it sounded to me, the way we were talking about it, like that the roadshow was intended to help define what I would call classical liberal values moving into a digital era, really.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think what we're finding, and this is a separate but interesting conversation, is that technology, particularly the internet and social media, seems to have amplified the angriest and most tyrannical voices in society. So instead of being a tool for liberation and free expression and free speech, it's being used as a tool of suppression and control. And the point that I was trying to make is, whatever your political values, my view is it's become more important to almost be absolutist in our defense of civil liberties, whether that's freedom of association, freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, the Second Amendment, freedom of religion. That when you mentioned Gramsci, what we've seen is a systematic undermining of all of those institutions of family, church, schools, by people who believe in the power of the state. So I think, not that we need, I don't want to advocate violence because I don't believe in that, but the phrase punch back twice as hard means that when we're having a conversation about what kind of, you know, what kind of money system we're going to have, or what kind of political system, it's not really a conversation right now. We're being talked at and threatened. And I think it's time for people who believe in these things. You know, this isn't a history lesson anymore. This is our chance to try and defend and articulate classical liberal values so that we can live our lives and pursue our interests the way we want. Because if we don't do that, then we will lose the argument.
Well, in our tradition, we've been publishing for well over 20 years now, we've defended the concept of a free market, the idea that people can come together in an open market and define their own prices, they can define their own products, they can build, and they sort of exist in a free society. And if you're able to create things that other people want, then that allows you to continue to be innovative and that kind of thing. We have defended that, but even that concept is, that's one of the classical sort of liberal values that's under siege. But at the same time, that argument of a free market is being used to defend the development of digital currencies. And if digital currencies are a weapon in trying to control people's behavior or whatever, it's an interesting dynamic. We have the opportunity to defend the traditions that we think are important, but at the same time, the way that money is being redefined is allowing for rampant speculation in the markets, which some people defend as free market behavior, and other people are just, I mean, they're not even paying attention. They're just trying to make a quick buck by buying at one price and selling at a higher price. And Joel, I'm going to bring you in here because you have written a few pieces on cryptocurrencies. I'm leading my way to there because to me, the speculative nature that is surrounding Bitcoin as the poster child for it all, but the advent of a new money system, that's the way a lot of people talk about it, is giving way to a lot of speculative behavior that is characteristic of many of the investment bubbles we've seen in the past. going back hundreds of years to when free markets began. Right now, I don't know where Bitcoin is today, but it's somewhere around 60,000, which is up considerably over the last year. How do you put the context of the conversation we're having in the argument you've been making for cryptocurrencies for over a decade?
Thanks, first of all, for inviting me on, and to the other guests for joining. But I'd first make, I think, a very important distinction between fiat cryptocurrencies, that is government-issued, state-sponsored, central bank digitalized currencies, and what the market is offering. I think what the market offers is something with entirely different motivations to that which, to the nefarious motivations that the state has in undermining individual privacy, being able to track your purchasing power. They'll no doubt use it for, you know, all kinds of nefarious purposes, all the way through to, you know, taxing you on goods that it doesn't approve that you're purchasing, and getting in the way of voluntary associations that you might want to have with, you know, whomever it is that with whom you wish to contract. So that's one type of money. It's brought into the digital realm by virtue of this cryptocurrency revolution. But it's, I would say that is very distinct from what we see and what we have seen for the last decade with the free market answer to fiat, i.e. paper money. And that's been a decentralized currency revolution, most notably, as you mentioned, in with the poster child being Bitcoin. But I think something that people commonly mistake here is that they'll say something like Bitcoin because it's not tangible. They'll mistakenly say that it's fiat, when that those two things, that's a real conflation of terms. They really don't have anything to do with one another. Fiat literally just means, and here I'm saying, telling the Greek and Latin geeks in the room, but fiat, for listeners who don't know, really just means by decree, by governmental decree. There is no Bitcoin government making any decrees. There is no Bitcoin central bank. There is no Bitcoin board of governors. So there's nothing fiat with regard to Bitcoin at all. So to conflate those two issues is to misunderstand quite what's happening there. But to bring it a little further back, and we can get to the speculative stuff in a second, because big numbers make sexy headlines. But to go back to to tie this back into the classics, I think what we're talking about here is the difference between a totalitarian impulse, which is a centralizing tendency that we see within nation states and governments, whether in Europe, North America, or whatever continent you happen to, down here in South America, certainly has no shortage of that in its history. But when it comes to the state, we see big centralizing tendencies. In the market, we see exactly the opposite. We see almost a centrifugal force spinning out, decentralizing to, you know, this is Schumpeter's creative destruction in hyper acceleration, aided and accelerated and catalyzed by the digital age. So it would make sense that we see improperly used or lethargic capital liberated from inefficient businesses in this kind of, you know, this kind of hyper-evolutionary free market system. And so we shouldn't be surprised to see that there's a lot of innovation. There's a lot of highs and lows, that prices would go crazy. We're still at the, you know, even though it's a decade in, that's a blip. You know, when we're talking about the history of money, for example, you know, gold's got thousands of years of history. So we're still at the very, very bleeding edge of this. And so we should be, you know, we should expect to see a lot of turbulence with regards to prices. But I would just make that kind of primary distinction between what I think Dan was talking about there with regards to government issued cryptocurrencies and free market cryptocurrencies, because they're very different and they have very different motivations behind them. One being to centralize and coerce and control people, and the other being to liberate and free people from that very impulse. Yeah, I mean, look, if you didn't have any of it for the last 10 years, it's kind of a painful episode to sit by and watch. And that goes back to FOMOing. And I think that there's no doubt that people, you know, everybody, you know, has a story that, oh, so-and-so told me about it when it was at such and such a price. And then they do the math in reverse, which is never healthy for one's mental quietude or ability to have, you know, fitful.
I actually have a story.
Rest. Everybody. Well, I want to hear the story.
No,
everybody's got one.
when you and I and Jeffrey Tucker were writing together, Jeffrey was trying to convince me that Bitcoin was a thing. And I was like, yeah, I understand like the sort of libertarian free market perspective of why it would be important. I get that. And he's like, you ought to invest in one. And he's like, oh, well, in fact, I'm going to open you a wallet and I'm going to give you a Bitcoin. And I think it was a dollar at the time. And so he opened a wallet, gave it to me, and it was a dollar. That was probably in 2009 or something like that. And I was like, oh, thank you, Jeffrey. You just gave me a buck. And I don't know where that wallet is or how to get into it, whatever. But it would have multiplied, what is that, 600,000%?
Yeah, it's a non-trivial increase.
Yeah.
Well, I think you're orbiting around the same issue in that it's an important issue about the whole conversation, because if we're talking about how much money we didn't make in dollars because we didn't invest in Bitcoin early, we're still talking about dollars. We're not talking about Bitcoin. If we're talking about a new asset class that whose primary function is as a reserve asset for either institutions or central banks, or as a preservation of capital earned in any currency, then you don't really care about making money. You care about not losing purchasing power. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the huge move in Bitcoin in dollar terms prompts the question, what's really going on? Is it people trying to make money in dollars or in other currencies? Or does it signal that at the margins in the entire financial system, there's a wholesale loss of confidence in the de facto risk-free rate of return as defined by U.S. Treasuries in the U.S. dollar? And that's why it's fundamentally a monetary argument. And that's what makes it such an interesting contest between free market money and governments that want to try something like central bank money, is they realize to control power in the economy and in politics and society, you have to control the conversation over what money is. And so Bitcoin's move as a price signal says that other people think the government shouldn't have control of money. That's what we think. But also what's going on is people think, holy crap, I missed out on the best chance in my entire life to become a millionaire without doing any work in a society where the only way I can get ahead now is borrow money. So you know, you have two completely competing narratives about what explains the price action.
Yeah.
Well, that kind of speculative idea that you can become rich without investing anything, I think that that's kind of the root of sort of the cultural malaise that we're involved in right now. Like the idea that you can invest or you can work hard, save your money, invest, build a business, and educate yourself and your family. All of those things get thrown out the window when you hear somebody took a dollar and made $60,000 out of a Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, didn't happen, but
until you find that,
it's out there somewhere.
Until you find that pen drive under the couch cushion. And look, there's definitely, no doubt there is exactly the kind of moral hazard that is explained by Mises et al. With regards to, you know, just massively loose fiscal and monetary policy and the malinvestment that follows as a natural. That naturally follows subsequent to that. You know, people are, Anya and I are down here in Argentina, and we see, I think it's officially maybe 55% inflation, but everybody knows it's much higher than that down here. And so we see these economics lessons, you know, every time we buy a bunch of flowers or, you know, go to a restaurant or, you know, pay our kids school fees. People, they need to spend their way out of Argentine pesos as quick as possible because they know that by the end of the week, it's going to be worth that much less. So for a lot of people down here where currency controls or rather capital controls come into play and they're restricted in the amount of dollars that they can buy, they're restricted in the amount of gold that they can purchase, they're restricted in the amount of money or real assets that they can move offshore, then we can easily see the appeal of something that you don't have to walk over the border in gold coins that are sewn into the hem of your tattered old trench coat, a la, you know, 1940s Germany or what have you. We see people, they say, hey, you know, I can invest in literally out of the window of my apartment here. There's a billboard sign for, I don't know how it's pronounced. It's DAI, D-A-I currency. And it's one of these stable currencies that's fixed one unit to $1. And you can, I mean, I can easily appreciate how somebody who is watching their central bank just fritter away the value of their pesos in Argentina's account, why that would be appealing. Cryptocurrency, and I'm talking about free market cryptocurrency, not about this cheap hack and eye bullshit simulacrum that the governments around the world will be offering their obedient citizens. Free market money in the form of cryptographically secured currency is a bet. It's going long government stupidity. It's saying governments will continue to debase our currency, and I'm going to bet that happens. And so far, it's been a pretty good bet. That's not to say that in the next, you know, that by the end of this conversation, there hasn't been a roaring bear market that has just blown through like a forest fire through the, you know, the cryptocurrency world and doused, you know, all the weekends. That obviously can happen, and it'll be a spectacular ride going forward. But that central and that understanding that free market monies, whether they're gold, whether they're cryptocurrencies, are a bet that governments will keep doing what governments do, I think.
Can I just add that to Joel's point? I mean, here in Argentina, you know, we see the hyperinflation, and so the bitcoins and cryptocurrencies are used to preserve people's wealth rather than make a buck. But where you really see it, where it's super popular, is in Venezuela. And, you know, that is an ongoing crisis. And we've lived in a few different countries in Latin America, and you see Venezuelan refugees everywhere. I mean, it is an ongoing crisis, and cryptocurrencies are literally helping people survive that. So it's playing a very important role for those people in that situation.
Yeah, I think that's sort of like the philosophically interesting thing, because the restrictions that you were talking about putting in place, Venezuela has tried that for years and years, and the even with restrictions in place, the confidence level erodes to zero, and right. people can't even feed their families at a point, right?
Yeah, and remember the Venezuelan government, just to draw a sharp distinction between a fiat crypto, which would be a government issued crypto, and a free market crypto. Recall that the Venezuelan government introduced its own crypto, the like Petro coin Bit Petro or some garbage. Anyway, lo and behold, that didn't take off. It wasn't because people didn't have faith in math. It was because people didn't have faith in the Venezuelan government, which is a pretty good bet.
Well, what is a good way? I'm curious myself. Like, what's a good way to distinguish between a fiat crypto and a free market crypto?
Well, anything that sounds like GovCoin FedCoin. Yeah, exactly. I remember during the kind of early days of, you know, Bitcoin came on the block, and then there was this proliferation of all these different types of coins that had slight genetic modifications and were tailored toward different, you know, segments of the market, some to, you know, anonymity or micro donations, whatever little niche of the market they were trying to fill. We saw this massive proliferation of so-called altcoins during the early days. And I remember having discussions with people who were indicting Bitcoin for saying, hey, this is inflationary. Look, there's XYZ coin down the road and they don't have a cap of 21 million. So I thought you said that Bitcoin was limited supply. Now that's inflationary. I think, again, that's more confusion in terminology and jargon there, where when we have more participants offering goods or services in a particular market, we don't call it inflation. We call it growth. That's economic growth. That's more hot dog vendors offering their wares at the park or whatever. But just in the same way that the US Federal Reserve printing more currency units there doesn't affect the inflation or the velocity of money for people in Iceland that are not using their money, it's a similar way to say that inflation is contained within an individual coin offering. So the inflation rate in Bitcoin is always dependent on that curve. And everybody's seen that graph of, I guess, non-exponential growth with the amount of coins being released and the halvings and such and such gets a little bit inside baseball. But that's again another one of these other misnomers to say, oh, now there's, last year there was 100 altcoins, now there's 10,000 altcoins. So what's to stop you, Addison, or me, Joel, or Anya, or Dan, or the Venezuelan government from releasing our own coin into the marketplace? Well, nothing. But that's a feature, not a flaw.
What you're talking about is right. The difference is that no one's telling you what something is worth, which is what you said basically by fiat, that it has value because you're told that it's legal tender by the only person who has a monopoly on telling other people what money is. Hmm. So if you wanted to distinguish between fiat and anything else, well, why do people believe that money has value? Well, one, because they use it. And lots of things have been useful as money over time. It could be salt, could be pepper, it could be cowrie shells. You know, there's lots of interesting books on the utility value of money. Another is that they believe it. So they don't believe it because they're told by the government that it's money, although that's the case for many people now, but that they believe gold has value. It's useful as well. Or that they save in it. That's a third reason, that you don't tend to save in assets that you think lose value over time. That doesn't mean you use them to pay for things on a day-to-day basis, but it means that you're not told, you don't have to be told that something has value. That's why people buy real estate. That's why they bought pianos in Weimar, Germany. They were looking for tangible assets that they could either liquidate at a value, or at least not, their money wasn't stored in paper currency, which the government was constantly adjusting to a new value. And I mean, I think the most interesting part with cryptos, which I will admit I don't know very much about, and I think, Joel, it was a spoonerism, or I can't remember the correct term, but I thought you said griftos at one point instead of cryptos, which I thought was quite nice.
That is a spoonerism.
But it's the value of the network. How do you value Bitcoin? Well, you don't value it in dollar terms. You value it in the network, the number of people that are using it to move value around the world, whether that's to pay for dinner or to move assets from one place to the other. And that's more of a technology issue. When we talked about the first mover advantages and the network effect with Facebook and with WhatsApp and with Google and YouTube, to me, that's been the most interesting way of looking at it. But the first three are traditional. Do people use it? Do they save in it? Do they believe in it without being told that it's valuable? And the fourth is really a question of utility. Is the larger the network gets, then the more it indicates that people believe that in one form or another, as either a savings mechanism or as a means of conducting transactions, this has more value than that.
That's an excellent point. And that differentiates between another misnomer, which is that there is this thing called intrinsic value, where, you know, you just dig something up like an ingot of gold from the ground, and it just has the price stamped on it. And then that's just, it's somehow in the thing itself. You know, this is something that's often leveled against cryptocurrencies because they're not tangible. People make the mistake of saying, well, there's no intrinsic value. But of course, the Austrians understood that there is no such thing as intrinsic value, that value comes from that it's actually, value is subjective, and it's dependent on a thing's utility toward us. We imbue things with value depending on whether or not we find them useful. And that can change just given our circumstances. We would obviously value a glass of water very differently if we have just, you know, stumbled out of a 40-day wandering around the desert with a mouth like at the bottom of a birdcage, or if we're standing under the Niagara Falls. Water has a different value because it has a different usefulness to us in that particular moment.
And on that point, by the way, the scarcity is an element in both Bitcoin and gold. That's a physical quality of gold because it takes energy and labor and knowledge to find it, which from a monetary point of view means it's impossible to expand the money supply and create inflation with a pen. Bitcoin, that scarcity is programmed in cryptographically. So in that sense, you can see the common ground between people, that it's a unit that cannot be increased artificially by a committee.
All right. My Swiss cuckoo clock just went off, which means we've now been talking for an hour. And Dan, I believe you have a lunch engagement or something.
Time is money. That unit doesn't change either. So yeah, I have to go.
I'll see. Now it's been clocked. But I do want to...
I hope you're not appropriating Swiss culture there, Addison. That's a cancelable offense, I'll have you know.
Racist, imperialist.
Patriarch.
I just did Ancestry.com, and I don't have Swiss in me, but for some reason I have 12% Swedish.
That won't cut it, mate. That's cultural appropriation. You're out of here. Yeah,
but 12% is not enough. But I do want to just, I feel like this conversation, this was kind of an experiment to get the four of us together, but What I'm hoping it will do is open up a loop, a couple loops about cryptocurrency, the value of money, and the classical traditions that we have developed over time to understand things like we had a big discussion about free markets. Like that is central to Austrian economic theory. To me, economics is just an expression of human behavior. Like how do we understand each other and how do we survive? How do we take care of our family and friends? And how do we express our ambitions and that kind of thing? So I'm hoping that this will open a discussion for the Wigan sessions, which I'm going to, all next week, I'm going to write about it. So, and I have been for a couple of weeks now.
But can I make a request before you go? Because I would like to hear from Anya on what we can learn from the classics about devaluation, inflation, and the social and political consequences. Because I think if anyone still studied them seriously economically, they would see that there's a lot to be learned about today's modern monetary world from studying what happened in the ancient world, if people bothered to do that anymore.
What do you mean, like with regards to the end of the Roman Empire and how they used to? I mean, it is a fantastic story because you can see it in history and you can see the three different ways that they would inflate it by taking the money and clipping it and arresting their high citizens and stealing their wealth. And of course, the other big one is expanding in territories and taking over in different regions and then taking the wealth there. And you're like, let's see the comparisons to our modern world. Let me list ways. So, yeah, it's remarkable when you look at those ancient examples and they have such clear parallels to our modern world. And yet we just accept them like that they're normal and we don't question them and we don't fight against them. And we can see what the end result was in the ancient world and yet not apply that to ourselves. We seem to not want to learn the lessons that history has so conveniently laid out for us.
Can I just say, like, how easy it would be to not learn those lessons if those lessons were stricken from the historical record, which is what is being threatened right now with regards to cancel culture. I mean, Anya started off by outlining, you know, just how much we would miss out on if we were to cancel. Anya and I have been talking about this for a little while, and we kind of jokingly call it Homericide in our evening sobre mesa, but if it were possible to cancel Homer's twin epics, it's not as if you just walk in. It's like walking into an ecosystem and taking out one tiny little animal and expecting that there'll be no ripple, you know, butterfly effects throughout the rest of the ecosystem. You take out those twin epics and it's kind of hard to find a place for Virgil to go. So you've got no Aeneas, then you've got no, where's Dante? Where's Paradise? Where's Milton's Paradise Lost? Where's Joyce's Ulysses? I mean, it has this domino effect all the way down through history. So it's, you know, you take one Jenga piece out. Okay, maybe you can do that a couple of times, but you know, you get deep into the game, you have a couple of shots and the music's going, you take a few Jengas out and all of a sudden you've just got, you know, a pile of useless things on the ground and you're back to square one. And I was calling to mind Newton's famous phrase, we can see so far because we stand on the shoulder of giants. It occurs to me that in today's cancel culture, they're worried about seeing so far because they feel these giants on their shoulders, to kind of invert that phrase. And, you know, we're going to be running around like little dwarfs, not able to see over our own toes if we go on canceling our history.
Yeah, well, the one optimistic thing about classics is they have lasted for thousands of years. And there have been many periods in history where the classics were banned. As I was preparing for this conversation, I was just recalling how the Catholic priest Savonarola squashed the Renaissance in Florence when de' Medici and Michelangelo and da Vinci were all active in cultivating secular art. And Savonarola was elected by the people and he squashed the entire thing. But what happened to him 5 years later was he disappointed the entire populace and they hung him in the town square.
Yeah. Can I just say that, you know, we think about the fact that during the dark ages, the medieval period, the Islamic world, you know, kept on holding on to the classics and preserving them for later on, when they reinvigorated in the West. And if it makes everyone feel better, I talked to a lot of professors and each of them have sort of their different niche. And so the other day I was talking to a man who focuses on Plato, specifically Plato's Republic. And apparently in the Far East, they love Plato. And he is flown out to Taiwan like at least twice a year for big Plato conferences. And then I was talking to another professor who is a specialist in skepticism, in John Hopkins, actually. And he gets flown down here to South America all the time because there's a huge skeptic movement. So while the West wants to burn its own history, rest assured, at least in other countries, it's valued.
Well, that sounds like a good note to end on. Rest assured. All right. Well, thank you, guys. I will be in touch soon. And thank you for joining this episode of the Weekend Sessions. That was Anya Leonard, Joel Bowman, and Dan Denning. Thank you for listening to the Wiggins Sessions. Dig in and defend the classics with Anya at classicalwisdom.com. And while there, make sure you check out the Essential Greeks Classical Course. You can also follow Dan Denning's advice at the Bonner Denning Letter.